so today I'm going to talk about twisted connect sum constructions. Constructions of G2 manifolds. And so there are two basic references by Cordy, Haskins, Nordstrom, and Machini. So 1206-2277 was kind of the algebraic geometry part, and we'll talk about some of that. And then 1207-4470 is the G2 manifold part. And I also want to mention, and I'm going to discuss for a few minutes right at the beginning, a beautiful paper of Beauville from much earlier, math.ag 0021131. Okay, so if I go too fast, you can have a chance to go back and look. So this paper of Beauville is about an algebraic geometry problem. So this is going to be some algebraic geometry preliminaries. And the first problem is actually older than this paper of Beauville, and it asks the following question. Suppose S is a K3 surface, and C on S is an algebraic curve. Then one of the things that we, non-singular algebraic curve, one of the things that we discussed earlier is that the self-intersection of C is 2G minus 2. So if G is at least 2, that's when the self-intersection is positive. And in that case, C, well, it doesn't have to be an ample divisor, but it has to be pretty close. So the map given by the linear system C will send S to some S bar, which is some K3 with rational bubble points at worst. But for generic such K3, we'll have an embedding into projective space of S itself. Sorry, S bar will then be contained in some projective space, and actually it's PG. So you can ask about the hyperplane sections for that embedding. So I want to look at the hyperplane section of this. And the hyperplane section of this is a divisor in this linear system. So that is some curve C, which is linearly C prime, which is linearly equivalent to C. And the adjunction formula tells you that the canonical bundle of C prime is the canonical bundle of S plus C prime restricted to C prime. Canonical bundle of S is trivial. So this is just C prime restricted to C prime, otherwise known as the normal bundle of C prime in S. And that normal bundle is just O of 1, OPG of 1, with respect to the pullback of OPG of 1. I should maybe call it pullback, with respect to the embedding into projective space. So we have a situation in which the embedding of the K3 surface into projective space takes a hyperplane section and embeds that hyperplane section canonically by the linear system KC prime. So another way of saying this is that the linear system C restricted to C prime is the same as the linear system KC prime. The canonical linear system on the curve C prime embeds it into, so that's going to, there's going to be a map just abstractly from C prime into this hyperplane, which is a copy of PG minus 1. So we have this interesting situation. One of the really good ways of studying a Riemann surface is to take its of genus at least 2, is to take its canonical map, which is an embedding if the curve is not hyperelliptic, to take its canonical map into PG minus 1. And this is saying that if you have a K3 surface, its hyperplane sections are automatically things that have such a canonical map. And it raises the immediate question, is every algebraic curve the hyperplane section of some K3 surface. So I'm going to do a simple dimension count. The dimension of the moduli space of K3 surfaces of with a polarization of degree 2g minus 2, so I'm just going to write that like this, 2g minus 2. We discussed this. Those moduli spaces all have dimension 19. If I've got my K3 surface embedded in PG, then the dimension of the set of hyperplanes, which is PG dual, right, is G. So the total number, dimension of the set of C, such that C is in S, is less than or equal to 19 plus G. I don't know for sure that every curve that can be contained in a K3 surface can only be contained in one of them. So it might be that I have to remove some kind of stabilizer dimension here, but the dimension would be at most 19 plus G. But on the other hand, the dimension of the moduli space of curves of genus G is 3g minus 3. And so the question is, could it be that 19 plus g is greater than or equal to 3g minus 3? And the answer is only if g is less than or equal to 11. So if g is bigger than 11, there's no hope for the curve to be on a K3 surface. In fact, the situation is interesting. It turns out that every curve of genus G less than or equal to 9 and G equals 11, generic curve, excuse me, of genus G less than or equal to 9 and genus G equals 11 is on a K3. But for G equals 10, it's also this map is also not surjective. Sorry, I didn't write down a map, but in other words, the generic curve of genus 10 is not on a K3 surface. That's a beautiful result of Mackay. Maybe someday I'll give some talks about that. That's great stuff. Well, now I want to go up a dimension and, in fact, point out that there's one natural way in which you would get... Right, so implicitly I said surjective. So implicitly I'm looking here at pairs, set of S and C up to isomorphism, and I'm mapping down to the set of C's, right, up to isomorphism. So when I talked about the map being surjective, this was the map that I had in mind. And now there's an obvious way that you might get a fiber, namely, if Y is a Fano threefold. Fano threefold means that minus KY is ample. And S is a smooth divisor in the linear system minus KY, then the same adjunction formula that I did before, so KS looks like KY plus S restricted to S, but S restricted to S because it's in this linear system minus KY is minus KY. So that's equal to zero. So, and in fact, so KS equals zero doesn't completely imply it, but in fact, S is K3. So when I have a Fano threefold, I think we're just being locked in. If I have a Fano threefold, then its hyperplane sections are K3 surfaces. The hyperplane sections of the K3 surfaces are canonical curves, but if you had, so here's Y containing S containing C, if Y was a hyperplane section of S, then C would be a double hyperplane section of Y, but that would mean that any hyperplane within the one parameter family that take the linear combination, so I would get H1 intersect H2 intersect Y, any of those linear combinations would be a K3 surface containing C. So that actually causes there to be a bigger fiber for a map like this. So the thing that I wanted to quote...
Sorry, could you maybe go over it quickly what happened?
Yeah, sorry. So what just happened here was that I did the adjunction formula, so that told me that if I had a smooth divisor at minus KY, it's a K3 surface. So actually Y is gonna have to go into P G plus one. It's containing S, which goes into PG, and it's containing C, which is in PG minus one. And the point I was just making was that C would then be the intersection of Y with two hyperplanes. The first hyperplane picking out S, second hyperplane picking out C. But now if I take Y intersect any combination, C1H1 plus C2H2, that's a horrible notation, you know what I mean? Any linear combination there, that is, that's another K3 which contains the curve C. So there's a whole one parameter family of K3s containing the curve C. And that means that this map has a bigger fiber than you might have hoped. So you might have hoped that this was a finite map. And that makes this problem even worse a little bit. So. Okay, so so Bovell proved a beautiful theorem, which I'm just gonna state. We'll use actually a generalized version of it proved by Cordy et al., these other guys. And Bovell's theorem says, now let's look at the moduli space of pairs, YS. So that was kind of like my space here, except now I'm doing it with the Fano threefolds. And that's gonna map to a moduli space of K3 surfaces. Well, over here I talked about a moduli space of K3 surfaces labeled by a genus. And in fact, here there's one other thing I should point out, which is that there's a map from the Picard group of Y to the Picard group of S. And the Picard group of S naturally looks like it's contained in the K3 lattice, lambda 319, and let me just call that N. So I want to look at a subset of the moduli, MK3 super N, which is the set of all K3s S, such that N is embedded into the Picard group of S. Sorry, I want N to be the image of alpha. So the Picard group can be larger, but I know that there are some classes, this is just taking the line bundles on Y and restricting them to the hypersurface S, I get some classes in there. And Bovell's theorem is that this is generically surjective. For any Y. So if I have a type of Fano threefold, and there's a classification of Fano threefolds, there are only a finite number of algebraic families, but for any of those algebraic families, I get a surjection from the moduli space of pairs, Y and S, to the moduli space where I just look at the S. Except that the only K3s that I can consider are ones which have not just a single class like this one did. So over here, my lattice N, this is kind of a notation for a lattice of rank one, you just write in angle brackets the self-intersection of the generator. So there I had a lattice of rank one, and those were dimension 19. I should point out that in general, the dimension, so generally, the dimension of M, N, K3 is 20 minus the rank of N. So in the case where I was just taking a single algebraic curve and assuming that that was there, I got 19, but in general they're gonna be 20 minus rank N. Okay, so we'll describe this space in terms of periods toward the end of the talk. I just wanted to mention it here as this nice little geometric preliminary. And let me mention that Cordy, Haskins, Nordstrom, and Pacini proved a generalization of this. They generalize to Y is something called semifano, and I'll define semifano a little bit later on. But when I get to the semifano situation, I'm gonna have the same story that I've got a natural restriction map from the Picard group of the semifano to the Picard group of the K3 surface in it, and then the moduli space of pairs exists as a smooth stack and has a generally generically surjective map to the moduli space of K3s, whose Picard group contains this particular lattice N. Uh, let's see, why is it a lattice? I should point out that there's an intersection theory here, and the lattice would be L dot M dot minus K, or something like that. That would be a pairing on the Picard group of Y, and that makes the whole thing preserve the pairings. Okay, so that's the end of my algebraic geometry preliminary, which is stuff I probably could have said during the K3 lectures, but didn't think about it. So now I want to talk about G2 manifolds. And the starting point for the application in physics is the following question. If you had an 11-dimensional space, actually space-time, and you wanted to write that 11-dimensional space-time as some compact 7-manifold, Riemannian 7-manifold, times the Minkowski space, Minkowski 4 space, and if furthermore you wanted, okay, so I don't know if everybody in the room knows what spinners are, but they're these nice geometric objects which have to transform essentially like the square root of the so-called vector representation in a fixed dimension. So I want the spinners to sort of have at least one spinner preserved. So I want some spinner here, and then I have spinners here. And to make this work in Riemannian geometry, what I need is that the spinner is covariantly constant. So this metric maybe is called Gij, covariantly constant with respect to Gij. So manifolds with this property, as I'll explain in a minute, have Riemannian holonomy contained in the exceptional Lie group G2, compact Lie group G2. And so that's sort of the starting point from physics. We'll actually have a slightly different characterization of G2, but I kind of want to start there because that's the original motivation. You could do this for other situations like a 10-dimensional space-time. And for 10-dimensional space-time, the corresponding statement is that the holonomy is contained in SU3. And that turns out to lead to the Calabi-Yau condition. This one has applications to trying to compactify what's known as N-theory, which is a quantum version of 11-dimensional supergravity, down to Minkowski 4 space, keeping some supersymmetry, which is why you need a spinner hanging around in the process. Okay, so I said those words, and I'm not going to say any more about those words. Yes?
What's the physics reason for keeping some supersymmetry?
Because we have very good control over theories with supersymmetry, and for many years we were expecting, for lots of reasons, to see supersymmetry in space-time. Also, for many years we were expecting to see space-time which was Minkowski. Now, in the late 90s, we realized from the CMB data that Minkowski space is not the right approximation, probably should be De Sitter space instead. And in recent years, there has been increasing doubt that we will find evidence for supersymmetry at LHC energies. I don't think it's completely ruled out yet, but it's getting less and less likely as time goes on. So this now becomes a sort of an interesting theoretical model to sort of explore this class of four-dimensional compactifications. There's not as much motivation that really the world would be like this as there used to be, but that's why we're doing it. Okay, so what is how does the Lie group G2 show up? Well, what's holonomy, right? Holonomy is what on a Riemannian manifold, actually on a, it even works in the pseudo-Riemannian case. What you do with holonomy is you take loops in your space. There's something called restricted holonomy in which the loops are all assumed to be contractible, and full holonomy in which that assumption is not made. Almost all of my spaces will be simply connected, so that distinction doesn't matter, and I'm not going to make it. I take a loop in the submanifold, I parallel transport along that loop, And that parallel transport gives me a homomorphism from the tangent space at the point to the tangent space at the point, and it preserves the inner product defined by the metric. So in particular, that means that it's an element of the orthogonal group with respect to that inner product of the tangent space. So, however, it may, for some Riemannian metrics, the full holonomy is not generated. For example, if the metric is flat, the holonomy is completely trivial. Flat means that all the parallel transport comes back and gives you the identity map. So this classification by holonomy is something that was carried out in the Riemannian case by Berger in the late 1950s, who had a classification of the things that can occur. Although he didn't have examples of a few of the cases, one of his cases was ruled out in the early 60s. It was an error on his part. And then non-compact examples with the correct holonomy were constructed by, for the missing cases of G2 and spin7, were constructed by Robert Bryant in the 1980s, and then compact cases were constructed, the first ones were constructed by Dominic Joyce in the 1990s. And we're interested in compact examples, so we want a compact manifold with, well, as I'll explain in a moment, holonomy G2. So this group, SOTP, in any dimension, has a double cover called the spin group, spin TP. The group has a double cover called the spin group, and there's a representation of the spin group called the spinner representation. And it goes into a space of dimension roughly 2 to the 1/2 dimension TP. Of course, TP might be odd, so you have to be careful about that, but that's essentially what the spinner representation does. And I'm going to want a covariantly constant spinner. So what that means is that when I go around a loop in my space and do parallel transport, I can parallel transport spinners as well, so long as I have what's called a spin structure on the manifold, which means that I'm able to lift the structure group of the tangent bundle to the spin group. Then I've got a spinner representation, and I can try to parallel transport spinners along. And I want one which is, I want there to be at least one invariant spinner. So that's now in my compact 7 manifold. So the question is, if I have SO7, or more precisely spin 7, and I want to ask what is the stabilizer of a single spinner, some chosen spinner, a non-zero spinner, and that turns out to be independent of the spinner, and turns out to be isomorphic to the compact Lie group G2. So this is how G2 sort of ends up playing a role, that there's a little computation that one makes in representation theory about the stabilizer of a spinner in 7 dimensions, and it turns out to be this exceptional group G2. So let me just mention, summarize a little bit of the representation theory that's relevant of G2. If you've looked at the classification theory of Lie groups, then or algebras, then you recognize G2 as that sort of very strange case in rank 2, and it's got this Dinkin diagram with the three bars, and it never extends to anything bigger. It's kind of an outlier for lots of purposes. But what I want to do is discuss how the representations, the standard representations. I'm going to use V as an abstract name for TP. The standard representation theory of SO7 or spin7 decomposes under the action of G2. So if I take V and take the action of G2 on V, then that's just an irreducible 7-dimensional representation. And I'm going to use the notation, which is used sometimes in the physics literature, I'm going to call it 7-underline, just to denote its representation. If I look at the exterior, if I look at G2 acting on the second wedge product of V, then that turns out to be the 7 plus the adjoint representation of G2. That just means the representation on the Lie algebra G2, by the way, is a group of dimension. It's real, it's dimension 14. 14 to 7 is 21, which is the dimension of wedge 2B. If I look at the symmetric power of V and under the G2 action, that turns out to be an irreducible, sorry. So because I have a quadratic form, I should take sim2v0, that's the, there will be a one-dimensional sub-representation spanned by the metric form, and then there will be something else. And this is an irreducible 27-dimensional representation. Sim2v has dimension 28, but it had that one fixed guy, so we'll just call that 27. And then it turns out that if you look at the action on the third skew power, you get the 27 and the 7, and then a trivial representation. And so this is the form, or the three form, sorry. Another way to find it. That implies that G2 stabilizes a three form, a particular three form on the 7 dimensional. Sorry, I was just doing this in one tangent space, but then it's got holonomy G2. So if I have holonomy G2, then that particular subspace of the tangent space, I'll be able to follow around and produce, subspace of wedge 3, I'll be able to follow around and produce a 3 form. So here I was sort of defining holonomy G2 by wanting a spinner to be stabilized, but here I can define it by wanting a particular 3 form to be stabilized. And in fact, G2 is isomorphic to the stabilizer of this 7 form, this 3 form, in wedge 3, I'll just call it wedge 3 R7. All right, so only certain 3 forms work, and it turns out that the set of real 3 forms whose stabilizer is G2 the stabilizer is isomorphic to G2, it is an open subset of wedge 3 R7. It's not a dense open subset. So this is real geometry. Some of the things we're used to in complex geometry don't show up. It turns out there are other open subsets whose stabilizers are non-compact forms of the Lie group G2. So probably most of you who've studied the classification of Lie groups have studied it in the complex case. In the real case, there's a very parallel theory in which you classify compact Lie groups, and then there's a compact real Lie group for each complex simple Lie group. So that makes a nice story, but it turns out there are other real Lie groups whose complexification is also the complex form of G2. The analogy for this is if you have the SOPQ groups, those are real groups preserving a form of some signature, indefinite signature, but those sort of extended to the complex numbers are all SOP plus Q, comma C, right? And a similar thing there, those groups preserve a non-degenerate quadratic form, and the signature of that quadratic form will divide the set of all quadratic forms into a bunch of open subsets, depending on what the signature is, and each of them gets a different stabilizer. So the one where everything goes on one side or the other, those two are compact, but other ones are non-compact. Same thing happens for G2. So there's a particular three form, and we'll actually write down an example of that three form, at least implicitly, in a couple of minutes. And these are called positive three forms. So I could think of a G2 holonomy manifold as something that has, sorry, this makes the holonomy be contained in G2. Similarly, if I have a family of three forms that are preserved, then I know that the holonomy is contained in G2, although I do not know that it has to exactly equal G2. We'll see examples where just stabilizing the three form doesn't cause it to actually be all of G2, but it could have been all of G2, potentially. Okay, so I want to give some examples of this structure. So I already mentioned, and I want compact examples. In fact, my first examples will be compact. So the first example is a 7 torus. So I choose some Z7 in R7, and I make a 7 torus. It has a flat metric. So yes, there's a 3 form that's preserved. If I could do linear algebra here and figure out which one is the positive 3 form, then I could use that positive 3 form, parallel transport all over the place. I get a 3 form on the manifold that gives me a holonomy G2 structure, but the holonomy is actually trivial, which is a subgroup of G2, so that's good. So that looks like a slightly boring example, but I'll need it for something. I can have T3 cross a K3 surface, T3 cross S, where S is K3. And here, I'll use the notation capital Phi for a positive 3 form. The positive 3 form is kind of cool. So it looks like d theta 1, wedge d theta 2, wedge d theta 3, where theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3 are the natural coordinates on the 3 torus. I'm choosing an orientation, actually, implicitly by the way I write this formula. And then I have to take the sum of d theta j wedge omega j equal 1 to 3, where omega 1, omega 2, omega 3 are an orthonormal basis of the positive harmonic forms. So I remind you a few things about K3. So I'm taking the a K3 metric, so a Ricci flat metric on K3, and remember that a Ricci flat metric determined and was determined by a choice of positive 3 plane inside of H2 of S with real coefficients. And you can choose an orthonormal basis, no problem, inside that positive 3 plane. And then I'm taking a combination where I use my basis elements wedged together with those d thetas to form an additional 3 form. So this turns out to be, so you can locally write down in terms of coordinates on K3 what those forms omega are supposed to look like. And that implicitly is giving me an example of a G2, a positive 3 form that's used for G2. And I said it had to be oriented. If you switched theta 2 and theta 3, these terms would be invariant, but this would change sign. And that's actually not allowed. So I have to carefully choose orientation to make this work. And then my third example is S1 cross Z, where Z is a Calabi-Yau threefold. And in this case, my phi will be d theta wedge little omega plus the real part of capital omega, where little omega is the Kähler form. But again, I'm using the Ricci flat metric to make this work. Little omega is a Kähler form of Z, and capital omega is a holomorphic 3 form. So here there's a bit of a choice. I'm actually having to choose a holomorphic 3 form, or more precisely, choose the phase of a holomorphic 3 form in order to decide which part, real or imaginary, is going to contribute to my phi. But once I've done that, I get a 3 form of the right kind. Here the holonomy was SU2. Here the holonomy is, which is contained in G2. Here the holonomy is SU3, which is contained in G2. Okay, so now I want to take slight variance of this. So 1 prime is going to be an orbifold of T7. So G is a group, finite group, whose fixed points are in real codimension 4, and the stabilizer of a point lies in SU2 contained in real codimension 4 contained in SO4. So the fixed point locus is in real codimension 4 means that I can sort of study the stabilizer by looking in the transverse space. So the transverse space is a four-dimensional space. It would normally have rotations SO4, but I'm going to insist that the stabilizer be a subgroup of SU2 inside of SO4. So these are Joyce orbifolds. So it turns out that was the necessary condition. I could have said it a little more abstractly to say that I'd chosen a particular positive free form and I want G to stabilize the positive free form. I certainly should say that. G fixes a positive free form. And then this turns out to be the essential condition to make sure that it can fix a positive three form. These are called Joyce orbifolds, and what Joyce, and these are the original construction of compact manifolds with holonomy G2. What Joyce proved is that there is something analogous to a resolution of singularities . Well, it's not quite the one we do in algebraic geometry because it's odd real dimension, but there's something like a resolution of singularities that you build essentially by plumbing in the known resolution of the ADE singularities, which have a metric form. You glue that in where there used to be singularities. You have to patch together using a partition function, and then you have something that's close to a G2 structure, it's close to a G2 structure, and then you prove that there's some limiting process which takes you to a G2 structure. So there's some hard analysis in this proof. I'm not going to talk about the analytic aspects at all. I'm only going to talk about the algebraic geometry ingredients that go into the construction. So this was the first class of examples of compact G2 manifolds. For example, actually I should call it 3 prime. For example, 3 prime, I want to take, not forgetting anything, no. I want to take S1 cross Z mod Z2. And Z2 is supposed to be acting by complex conjugation on capital Z and by theta goes to minus theta on S1. So this only makes sense if Z is defined over the real numbers. So all Calabi-Yau threefolds are algebraic. They're algebraic over the complex numbers. That means there's some way of putting them into complex projective space and defining them by a bunch of polynomial equations in complex projective space. If we can choose generators for those polynomial equations, which all have real coefficients, that's to say that Z is defined over R, and that means that when you complex conjugate the solutions, you'll get an involution on the set of solutions if all the equations are real. So I want that involution. This actually gives, this is smooth if, in algebraic geometry language, the set of real points on the variety is empty. In other words, there are no fixed points under complex conjugation. Then obviously this is smooth. Maybe I should say if and only if. And if it's singular, you can again resolve. You can resolve the Z2 locus. And this case right here where it's smooth is called barely G2. And the holonomy in this case, in the barely G2 case, maybe I'll stick with yellow, the holonomy is just SU3 semi-direct Z2 sitting inside of G2. So I don't get full G2 this way, but I do get an interesting class of things which have essentially a G2 structure. By doing this, I'm preserving this part of the structure, but I'm not preserving anything else from the structure. Under complex conjugation, the Kähler form will change sign, the d theta will change sign, and the real part of omega is invariant. So the form phi is preserved. For my last kind of set of examples, I want to talk about G2 cylinders. I'm going to combine some aspects of these previous examples, and I'm going to use three colors. Okay, so I'm going to start with my, I guess we could call this something like 2 prime, although it's not going to be compact initially. I'm going to start with my T3, but I'm going to draw the three circles in the T3 in three different colors. And the blue does not look terribly visible to me. Is the blue visible? It's okay, okay. So I'm going to do this crossed with K3. And now I'm going to unwrap orange. So I'm going to end up with a blue circle and a green circle, and then a long orange red line. And of course, just to remind you, I've got, still got my blue circle over here and my green circle down here. So that's crossed with K3. And when I unwrap it, I am going to again use the metric, and I'm going to rename the orange variable to x. So this will just be d theta 1 wedge d theta 2 wedge dx plus d theta 1 wedge omega 1 plus d theta 2 wedge omega 2 plus d theta 3, excuse me, dx wedge omega 3. So there's this beautiful thing called Donaldson matching. And it's the observation, so this is kind of, this is, I'm calling it a G2 cylinder because it's got this T2 cross K3 part, and then it's got a long real axis. So it's a cylinder whose cross-section is T2 cross K3, if you like, whereas an ordinary cylinder has cross-section S1. Donaldson matching says that if I were to map x goes to minus x, swap the two circles, and send omega 1, omega 2, omega 3 to, I neglected to mention, sorry, when I was reminding you about the K3 structure, I neglected to mention that the K3 metric keeps track of an orientation on that positive 3-plane. So having chosen a basis, omega 1, omega 2, omega 3, I wanted that to be an oriented basis, and my change of basis had also better be oriented. So I'm going to swap omega 1 and omega 2, but I better change the sign of omega 3 at the same time. And now you'll notice that if I do this, then phi is just preserved. So I swapped theta 1 and theta 2. I had to correspondingly swap omega 1 and omega 2. That forced me to change the sign of omega 3. So to compensate for that, I changed the sign of x. And now, fortunately, here I swapped these two, and this one I changed the sign, so that term is also preserved. So it suggests the following idea, which was implemented first by Kovalev and then extended vastly by Corti et al. And the idea is I'm going to find an asymptotically cylindrical G2 manifold. So my asymptotically cylindrical G2 manifold is supposed to look like supposed to look like this. So I want my blue circle and, blue circle should have been a little further over, my blue circle, and then my green. Of course, I'm going to have a green circle, but my green is going to be sort of capped off this way with the orange sort of in the middle of it. So here, I've got the two circles on the orange, but then I'm sort of imagining fibering this with circles in some way, right? And then it's capping off somehow on that side. Or I could take a blue guy who I'm going to cap off. So same story with an orange line. The orange line extends out further. And then a green circle. I'm supposed to cross it with a green circle down there. You know, I'm doing this crossing with circle. I'm not trying to draw it because I've got way too many dimensions. I've got 7 dimensions, which I'm trying to represent here on the board, and I think I'm doing a decent job of that. So if, so this is asymptotically cylindrical with x positive, right? And this one is asymptotically cylindrical, if I ignore the n, with x negative. So I could use Donaldson matching to try to glue them together. And in fact, Donaldson matching told me swap the circles. So the circle that I'm capping off here, I'm keeping here, and the circle that I'm capping off here, I'm keeping here. But the other thing I have to do in order to do this is make a transformation like this on the K3s. So the K3 up on this side has to be K3 omega 1, omega 2, omega 3, whereas the K3 on this side has to be K3 omega 2, omega 1, minus omega 3. But if I could do that, then what I would have sort of in the middle here, where it really is very close to being a product of the K3 and torus metrics, I'd be able to use that Donaldson matching to glue them together. I'm going to have to do the same business of use a partition of unity to kind of make everything sew together, and then invoke the same analysis that Joyce originally pioneered to show that there actually is a G2 structure here. Now, my green guy, my big green guy on this side and my big blue guy on this side are going to turn out to come from final threefolds. So the construction is that I have on one side, the side where x is going to be positive, I have y plus and s plus is going to give rise in a way that I'll explain in a moment to the cylinder, to the plus, let me just call it plus cylinder. And of course I'm going to want to take the product with S1 in this case. Then I'm going to have Y minus S minus, again cross S1, is going to be another cylinder. But these are different S1s. When I'm thinking of this, so now how is this related to a K3 surface in a Fano? Well, I'm actually going to have to modify Y a little bit. So I'm going to have to take some blow up of Y that I'll discuss in a moment, and I'm going to call that Z. Blow up of Y plus, I'm going to call Z plus. But essentially, the pair Z plus S plus, well, if I take Z plus minus S plus, that's going to be a non-compact Calabi-Yau threefold. So how does that come about? Well, remember that the anti-canonical divisor of the Fano threefold was supported on this K3 surface. So if I remove the K3 surface, I get something where the divisor is trivial. And this particular type of non-compact Calabi-Yau threefold, there is a variant of Yau's theorem, which tells you that there is a Ricci flat metric which is asymptotically conical. Well, you have to work a little bit to show that it's got the right asymptotically conical properties, and that's another thing that our friends Corti et al. Did. But the existence of the metric was already proven by Yau. So I get the metric on everything except for the S1 that way. I'm just taking a flat metric on S1 out in the middle here. Same thing for the other side. However, what I have to be able to do is match this K3 with this K3 with this very strange permutation of the three two forms that are generating the space of positive two forms. And so the question is, how am I going to do that? Well, I remind you, first of all, that the K3 that we're looking at, S plus, I should mention, right. So first of all, there's some definitions. So a weak Fano threefold, that's the situation. That they use is a non-singular y such that minus ky dot c is greater than or equal to 0 for all c, and minus ky cube is positive. That's called nef and big. This one's called nef, and this one, well, it's not quite the definition of big, but these two conditions are equivalent to nef and big. In the ample case, I would have had to assume strictly positive. So this is a relaxation. That relaxation has allowed for the construction of at least 50 million examples of this type, the distinct examples of this type. So it's good that we have a slightly more general situation. And then we're taking S plus, or we're taking S and a partner, S prime, we're taking to generate a pencil, an anti-canonical pencil. So we have to choose one for which there are at least two divisors in the anti-canonical series. And then Z will be the blow-up along the base locus of the pencil. So the intersection of S and S prime, essentially, of Y. So when you started out with one of these Fano threefolds, or a weak Fano threefold, and two anti-canonical hypersurfaces, typically they do meet each other. In fact, they sort of have to because of the ampleness criterion. But they'll meet each other in some curve. And if you blow up that curve, you will get a Z, which is now fibered over P1 with fibers are the K3 surfaces. We're choosing one of those fibers, namely S, to be where we're locating the anti-canonical divisor, and so when I push that one out to infinity and get this asymptotically conical structure, in fact, along the P1 direction, I've got, as I head towards infinity in P1, I've got a kind of radial direction and an angle direction, and those are where the asymptotically conical structure is going. So it sort of relates to this story in algebraic geometry. But what's weird about this story, and which is something which I had really not seen a specific application of this part of the K3 story until this thing came along, is that I need an algebraic K3 here and an algebraic K3 here whose data matches but with this very strange kind of permutation. In particular, I can think of omega 1 for S plus as being a Kähler class, but then omega 2 and omega 3 have to be coming from the holomorphic 2 form. Omega 2 plus I omega 3, if you like, is coming from the holomorphic 2 form. Whereas omega 2 of S minus should be the Kähler class with respect to that choice of complex structure, and omega 1 minus I omega 3 should be a choice of holomorphic 2 form. So how do we do this? Well, we talked about moduli space of K3 metrics and then moduli space of complex structures on K3s. The K3 metric here is determined by just the span of omega 1, omega 2, and omega 3. But because we're separating out the Kähler and complex parts differently, we actually have different complex structures. So in one case, we have omega 2, omega 3 spanning H2, 0 plus H02 real. And in the other case, I have omega 1 and omega 3 spanning those guys. Or alternatively, I can think of here omega 1 is going into H11, and on the other side, omega 2 is going into H11. Now, if I'm taking this moduli space of K3s with a fixed n, that means that I've chosen n to be inside of H11 of the K3, and so I have an implicit choice of complex structure. And in fact, since I'm taking an n which contains an ample class, I neglected to mention that, taking an n which contains an ample class, there's a Kähler class in here. In fact, there should naturally be a Kähler class in here. I started out with a projective variety Y. I'm restricting to a hyperplane section S, and so the ambient Kähler class is one of the line bundles on Y or on S, and that's the one that I'm going to be focused on for deciding how to embed algebraically this particular K3 surface. So that's going to be with n plus, but I'm also going to want a moduli space with n minus, and then it's going to be n minus, which is contained in H11. This was plus of S minus. So I've gone slower than I expected, so I'll be kind of quick now. I have these two different lattices, one of signature 1, comma rank n plus minus 1, another of signature 1, comma rank n minus minus 1. And what I know from the variant of Bovill's theorem, and just for completeness, semi-Fano is a subset of weak Fano, which says that the anti-canonical embedding of Y contracts no divisors to curves. Okay, it's a technical sounding thing. But if I'm in the semi-final case, then Cordier et al. Prove an analog of Bovill's theorem, which tells me that I can find a pair which realizes any generic point in this moduli space. So what do I have in this moduli space? Well, I can take n plus perp, right? So n plus perp will be this guy of signature 2, comma 20 minus rank n plus. Those are the spaces. Remember, the moduli spaces here would look like an SO2 this mod SO2 cross SO20 minus rank n plus. Those are the usual moduli spaces that have some nice complex dimension, 20 minus rank n plus. And saying that I have a generic surjection means that almost every point in that moduli space is realized by a pair. So what are the points that I want? I want points for which, in this complex structure space, so what I'm doing is I'm choosing a particular two-plane in there, which is defined by the real and imaginary part, but I want that two-plane to contain the lattice point, which is the ample class in n minus. So if it contains that particular lattice point, then I'll be able to make a change of complex structure, swap n plus for n minus, and have the same structure as I have at the moment. So all of this is assuming that I've managed to find an embedding of the direct sum into the K3 lattice, and you can use some of this work of Nakula to try to decide when that's true. There's a souped-up version of this in which n plus and n minus are allowed to overlap, and then you have to do a slightly more complicated construction. But anyway, in any event, what you essentially have to be able to find is a point in the period space where the two-plane that's defining the real and imaginary parts of the holomorphic two-form has a particular lattice point in it, which is this ample class in n minus. And those points exist. In fact, those points are it's a real manifold. It's a copy of hyperbolic space somehow. A real manifold sitting inside that complex manifold. And because of the Bovill surjectivity result, you can actually find, for the generic point on that real manifold, you can find a pair which realizes it. So the upshot is that analyzing this sort of K3 moduli story carefully, you can find a y plus n plus s plus. Now, those particular points I can then regard as being a subset of the SO 220 minus rank and minus locus. And again, there's another generic condition to impose, but from the other Bovill theorem, but the two open sets will have a non-empty intersection. So there are points that I can use that will correspond in both cases, and it's exactly those pairs that I choose to glue together. You can see from the construction that there are some moduli for this. The moduli will be staying in this locus, which is embedded in both of those moduli spaces, and then following along where the Fano threefold is, as well as the K3 surface. So you do this, you kind of do that asymptotic matching, you invoke the analysis part, and you produce a compact G2 manifold out of these two ingredients from algebraic geometry. So I'm going to spend a couple minutes, the last couple minutes, just giving an example of the structure, but I want to point out that I'm giving an example of the family, but I don't have any techniques for identifying exactly which pairs within that family satisfy having this extra lattice point in the H11. I think there's some room for doing some of those things, particularly if I ask for two lattice points in the H11, which is a little more than is being required here. Then I think we get into the story of complex multiplication or something analogous on the K3s. That, so far as I know, hasn't been worked out or studied. But I think it might be possible to find some examples that are a little more explicit than what I'm about to do. But I just want to mention a sort of variety of families that you might have. For Y plus, so this is sort of an example of the type of structure that you might see. For Y plus, I'm going to start with a quartic threefold, a degree 4 threefold in P4, which contains a P2. And that's going to be called X plus. Sorry, I never introduced X, which is the anti-canonical model of Y. It happens that when you have a quartic threefold, which contains a P2, and if you have, say, X1 and X2, so this is degree 4, X1 and X2 being the two linear coordinates, then there are cubics, F1 and F2, which let you write the equation like this, and this turns out to be singular at F1 equals F2 equals Q4 equals 0. That's 9 times 4 is 36 points. And you can do a blow-up. There's a small blow-up. This X1 equals X2 equals 0 is the locus that needs to be blown up. Small blow-up gives Y plus of Picard number 2. You create an extra divisor class, or the extra curve class, contains the blow-up of all these 36 points. Those are all, these are conifold points, and those are all P1s, which have the same homology class. Okay, so I can generate a Y plus of Picard number 2, and the associated lattice, it turns out, N plus looks like minus 2, 1, 1, 4, the 4 being the quartic thing that embeds here. That's not ample on Y plus. You could take a different combination which was ample on Y plus. For Y minus, I could take something maybe simpler. So I could do something with Picard number 1, for example, just to have a different one. I could have an intersection of a cubic and a quadric in P5. And that's a Fano threefold of Picard number 1. That one doesn't require any blow-ups. So N minus just has the self-intersection of the K3 is just 6. So N minus is just a single guy with a 6. Now, in this low rank, it's not hard to show that the direct sum of N plus and N minus definitely embeds into the K3 lattice. So I want to choose a Hodge structure positive 3-plane such that if I make these guys type H11, the remaining guy in here is still in the 3-plane. I guess I should choose two vectors. I should choose a vector here, a V plus, and a vector here, a V minus. And it's V plus and V minus that I want to make sure are both in the 3-plane. And then I can choose either the complex structure which makes V minus type 1-1. That will give me the Y minus S minus that I want to use for the second one. Or I can make the V plus type 1-1, and that'll give me the Y plus S plus that I want to use for the first one. And then I can glue them together. So it's known that there are a finite number of families of weak final three-folds, also semi-final three-folds, although the classification has not been done. But the families that people have sort of written down in some semi-systematic way lead to 50 million distinct types of G2 manifolds of this kind. Joyce's methods only gave a couple of hundred. So this is if you're interested in examples, this is a great advance. And I think I will stop right there. Any questions? Yeah?
So speaking of examples, I know for the physics we're interested in compact examples, but can you quickly say what Bryant's examples were?
So Bryant showed that if you were trying to solve for a Riemannian metric with exactly this holonomic G2 property, that those PDEs could be solved. And so he used some very clever methods, which actually essentially go back to Cartan, for solving overdetermined systems of PDEs. These are overdetermined, and he showed in the early 80s that these solutions existed. Bryant and Salomon subsequently constructed some examples with a complete metric, but not compact. And that was just a couple of years later. But then the problem remained open for another 10 years before Joyce's construction from the orbifolds. Other questions?
Was it that they were known to be non-compact, or just that there wasn't enough control on them to
tell? Bryant was only a local thing. So he was just proving the existence of a local G2 metric in some neighborhood in R7, some neighborhood of the origin in R7. Even that had not been known. The complete cases that Bryant and Salomon did were clearly not compact. They were cones over something, right? So that left the field wide open for Joyce.
Is it known how many there might be that have the full G2?
All of these cases have full G2 holonomy. Right. I gave simpler examples at the beginning which don't have full G2 holonomy. Many of those examples will appear as limits of these constructions, so there will be limits where the holonomy reduces, but these all have full G2 holonomy.
And is the total number estimated to be near this 50 million?
No. So 50 million is the published number in the paper. Mark Haskins tells me that it's up to like 300 million or something now, because they sort of refined it a little bit more. This is a beautiful construction, but these G2 manifolds look kind of special still, and we don't really know how to probe a general G2 manifold, so I think we're expecting many more of those. And I should mention that none of these are useful on their face in physics, because they don't have non-abelian gate symmetry when you conduct a Bayesian theory. We need examples that have some singularities that are put in, and I think we'll have some results in the next year or two pretty systematically analyzing the algebraic geometry part of putting the singularities in, but generalizing the analytic results that Joyce proved to cover singular cases is going to be a challenge. You're supposed to be making estimates on manifolds, and all of a sudden you don't have a manifold anymore, and so it's going to be a challenge. But anyway, people are going to be thinking about it.
Do you know who's involved with that now?
One of the reasons that I gave this talk is that there's this new thing, which actually hasn't really been announced too much yet. I guess we'll have some UCSB press about it one of these days. There's a thing called the Simons collaboration on special holonomy and special holonomy really means, mostly means G2 and spin 7 in geometry analysis and physics. And it's much faster to say Simons collaboration, special holonomy, geometry analysis, and physics. So this is a new collaboration that Simons Foundation recently funded for 4 years, which could be extended for another 3. And there are 10 PIs, and the PIs include they include me, Bryant, Joyce, Haskins, Nordstrom, Donaldson. Okay, now it gets embarrassing. There are 10 of us. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Sung, name begins with G. That's not good. Right, Salomon. I mentioned Salomon. He's on there. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Acharya. And I think it's spelled G-O-E-T-T-E, but I'm not completely sure about how to spell his name. Sebastian is his name. So those are the 10 people. That's equal. And anyway, so in various combinations, we're working on things like this, and we'll work with other people too. Yeah, so this is sort of one of the starting points. Other questions? All right. Have a good winter break. The Friday seminar in the winter quarter is going to be headed in a slightly different direction. Zhang Han and I are going to be coordinating more closely, and there will be more sort of three-manifold or quantum this and that stuff going on. I don't quite know yet exactly. You and I are discussing it on Monday, in fact. But then I might come back and do more of the G2 stuff in the spring.